We are now in the June 2022 personal injury reversal report. First case, Lungen, on page 6. It's an assumption of the risk case. Plaintiff was playing basketball. The court was wet with condensation. Second department held defendants were entitled to summary judgment in this basketball injury case. Plaintiff was deemed to have assumed the risk of slipping and falling on condensation on the floor of the court. The court wrote, the defendants established that plaintiff was aware of and had assumed the risk of the floor of the basketball court would be slippery from condensation that formed due to humid conditions in the gymnasium. The defendant's submissions, including the plaintiff's own deposition testimony, demonstrated that the plaintiff had played basketball in the gymnasium on more than 50 occasions prior to the day of the accident, knew that the gymnasium air was humid, and had dry mopped the gymnasium floor while playing basketball in the past when it was getting wet from condensation, and nevertheless continued playing basketball in the gymnasium on multiple occasions up until the date of the accident, despite his awareness of this condition. Under these circumstances, the plaintiff assumed the risk of injury inherent in playing basketball on an indoor court, which he knew to become slippery due to humid conditions. So the takeaway here, plaintiff was aware that the basketball court routinely became wet with condensation. Therefore, he assumed the risk of slipping on that condensation. Next is Bouchard. It's on pages 7 and 8. It deals with the concept of governmental immunity and the liability of the state in a negligence case. Third Department, in a comprehensive decision which should be consulted on the issues of governmental immunity, assumption of the risk, and constructive notice, reversing Supreme Court, held that the New York State Gaming Commission was exercising a proprietary, not governmental function when its employees inspected a harness racing horse, that's Mr. Miami's, equipment, and failed to scratch the horse, which exhibited indications he was lame, from the upcoming race. Claimant was injured when, during the race, claimant's horse collided with Mr. Miami after Mr. Miami fell. Because the state's alleged negligence stemmed from a proprietary function, ordinary negligence principles applied, and there was no need to show a special relationship between claimant and the state, and the governmental immunity affirmative defense was not available. There were questions of fact whether the assumption of the risk doctrine applied because the state may have acted to unreasonably increase the risk. As for notice, the regulations requiring the state to inspect the horses and equipment allowed the state's constructive notice of the dangerous condition to be imputed. The court wrote, the duties of the state's officials are fundamentally intertwined with the operation of each and every race, and while such tasks may tangentially relate to the overall function of ensuring fair and honest gambling in this state, they are more specifically directed to the goal of ensuring the safety of the participants in those races. It is apparent that at least part of the commission's role in harness racing is to work hand in hand with the private racing industry to further the state's goal of deriving a reasonable revenue for the support of government. We find that there are triable issues as to whether commission officials adequately perform their duties and whether their alleged failures unreasonably increase the risk beyond the level generally inherent in harness track racing. Because the inspection duties were imposed upon the commission officials by regulation, constructive notice of Mr. Miami's health and equipment issues that would have been observable during those inspections may be imputed. So the takeaway here, this opinion has valuable discussions of 1. How to analyze whether a government is exercising a governmental function to which the special relationship and governmental immunity doctrines apply, or a proprietary function to which ordinary negligence principles apply. 2. The assumption of the risk doctrine, and 3. The imputation of constructive notice when there are regulations mandating inspections which allegedly would have revealed the dangerous condition. Here, Claimant was injured during a harness race when his horse collided with a fallen horse. The complaint alleged the New York State Gaming Commission did not inspect the fallen horse and the fallen horse's equipment prior to the race, as required by the relevant regulations. Next is Freeman on pages 8 and 9, and it deals with the unique expert disclosure requirement in the Third Department with respect to a treating physician. The Third Department, reversing Supreme Court, held claimant's treating physician, Hobson, in this personal injury case, should have been allowed to testify as an expert despite the failure to comply with full expert disclosure pursuant to CPLR 3101. The Third Department is the only department which requires such full expert disclosure by a treating physician, and claimant's attorney had not practiced in the Third Department. The court wrote, "There's no dispute that claimant failed to comply with the expert disclosure requirements of CPLR 3101D in identifying Hobson as a witness. Nevertheless, we disagree with the Court of Claims finding that claimant's excuse was unreasonable. The situation here mirrors that in Schmidt versus Oneonta City School District, where we accepted the explanation of plaintiff's attorney that he was unaware of this court's interpretation of CPLR 3101D. And the corresponding need to file an expert disclosure for a treating physician, and the record was otherwise devoid of any indication that counsel's failure to file such disclosure was willful. The same holds true here, as claimant's attorney revealed that she practices law in a different judicial department and candidly conceded that she was unaware of this court's interpretation that the statute requires expert disclosure for treating physicians. There's nothing in the record calling into question the veracity of counsel's representations, and no basis to conclude that the noncompliance with CPLR 3101D was willful. As such, the court erred in precluding Hobson's testimony as an expert witness." So the takeaway here, only the Third Department requires full expert witness disclosure for a treating physician. Next is the matter of the City of New Rochelle, pages 9 and 10. It's a General Municipal Law 207A disability case brought by a firefighter. And the issue here was whether the manner of processing the firefighter's claim was covered by the arbitration agreement, so that the matter would be first determined in arbitration. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held a petition to stay arbitration in this General Municipal Law 207A injury claim by a firefighter should not have been granted. The manner in which a Section 207A claim is processed is an arbitrable manner under the arbitration agreement here. The court wrote, "The union filed a grievance alleging that the city was in violation of the collective bargaining agreement and the negotiated General Municipal Law 207A policy by failing to adhere to the required procedures in processing a claim by one of the union's members for General Municipal Law 207A benefits. It is undisputed that there's no constitutional, statutory, or public policy provision prohibiting the arbitration of the dispute at issue in this case. Given the breadth of the arbitration clause in this case, the dispute regarding the city's processing of claims for General Municipal Law 207A benefits bore a reasonable relationship to the general subject matter of the collective bargaining agreement, since Article 10 of the agreement expressly refers to the negotiated policy for the provision of such benefits. The question of the scope of the substantive provisions of the collective bargaining agreement is a matter of contract interpretation and application reserved for the arbitrator." So the takeaway here, the issue, how a firefighter's General Municipal Law 207A injury claim should be processed, was addressed in the collective bargaining agreement, and therefore was arbitrable. The petition to stay arbitration should not have been granted. Next is matter of Newman on page 11. It's another firefighter seeking General Municipal Law 207A benefits. Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court, held petitioner, a firefighter who had injured her shoulder on the job, was entitled to General Municipal Law 207A benefits. The court wrote, a firefighter seeking Section 207A benefits must show that his or her injury or illness results from the performance of his or her duties and that he or she is physically unable to perform his or her regular duties as a firefighter. The regular duties of a firefighter for the city required shifts of between 10 and 24 hours, and the medical evidence is undisputed that petitioner could work only 8-hour shifts. Inasmuch as the evidence established that petitioner could not work the longer shifts, and she was not offered the full-time equivalent of the shorter shifts or light-duty work, the determination that she was not entitled to General Municipal Law 207A benefits is arbitrary and capricious. So the takeaway here, the petitioner firefighter was injured on the job. When she returned to the job, she couldn't work the full 10 to 24-hour shifts, which are the regular duties of a firefighter. She was assigned shorter shifts, which resulted in less pay. She was therefore entitled to General Municipal Law 207A benefits. Next is Gonzalez on pages 12 and 13. It's a labor law construction accident case. First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held there were questions of fact which precluded summary judgment on plaintiff's labor law 240 subdivision 1 cause of action. Apparently, plaintiff fell while using stilts. There was a question of fact whether plaintiff's boss told him to work only on ground level without stilts. And there was a question of fact whether plaintiff was the sole proximate cause of his accident because he kept using the stilts when they became unstable and did not request another pair. The court wrote, given the nature of the work plaintiff was performing at the time of his accident, the distance he fell presented a physically significant elevation within the meaning of Labor Law 240 Subdivision 1. While the distance may have been physically significant within the meaning of 240 Subdivision 1, evidence that plaintiff's boss specifically instructed him to only work on ground level and not to use stilts raised triable issues of fact as to whether plaintiff's duties were expressly limited to work that did not expose him to an elevation-related hazard within the scope of Labor Law 240 Subdivision 1. Issues of fact also exist as to whether plaintiff was the sole proximate cause of the accident, because when he felt the stilts become unstable, his normal and logical response should have been to request another pair rather than to keep working. While it is disputed whether plaintiff was using his own stilts or his employer provided them, and it is further unclear whether the stilts failed because a screw came out while they were in use, or because they had been jerry-rigged with a wire threaded through a bolt hole. Any use of defective stilts or failure to properly inspect them to discern any such defect was not the sole proximate cause of the accident, whereas here, no proper safety devices were provided. So the takeaway here, where plaintiff fell using stilts, evidence plaintiff was instructed to work only on ground level precluded summary judgment on the Labor Law 241 cause of action. Plaintiff's continued use of the stilts after he felt them become unstable raised a question of fact whether plaintiff was the sole proximate cause of his injury. Next is Schoendorf, pages 13 and 14, another labor law case. The issue here was whether injury caused by lifting a very heavy object only a few inches brought the matter within the reach of Labor Law 240 Subdivision 1. First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiff's motion for summary judgment in this 240 Subdivision 1 action should have been granted. The pallet jack, which was deemed a safety device, wasn't long enough to fully lift the 400-pound elevator platform. Plaintiff was lifting the end of the platform, which was not supported by the pallet jack, in order to place another pallet jack under it when he felt his arm snap. The court wrote, plaintiff was injured as he was attempting to move a 400-pound elevator platform from the front of a flatbed truck to the tailgate. The platform, which was about 7 feet long, rested on a pallet jack that was too small to allow the platform to rest properly on it, causing the platform to dip and touch the flatbed. As plaintiff lifted the platform about 4 or 5 inches off the pallet jack in order to place a second pallet underneath to facilitate moving the platform, he felt a snap in his left arm. The pallet jack was a safety device that was insufficient to allow plaintiff to move the platform from the front of the flatbed truck to the tailgate. In view of the weight of the platform and the amount of force it was able to generate, even in falling a relatively short distance, plaintiff's injury resulted from a failure to provide adequate protection required by Labor Law 240 Subdivision 1 against a risk arising from a significant elevation differential. So the takeaway here, even a height differential of 4 or 5 inches can support a Labor Law 241 action. The plaintiff was attempting to lift a 400-pound elevator platform a few inches in order to place a pallet jack under it when he injured his arm, and that fell within the scope of Labor Law 240 Subdivision 1. Next is Sutherland on pages 14 and 15. Another labor law case. This time the issue was whether the plaintiff was the sole proximate cause of his injury, and that depended on whether he had the authority to stop work in the rain. The First Department, over a two-justice dissent, held conflicting testimony about whether plaintiff, who was a foreman, had the authority to stop work because of rain, or was instructed to work in the rain, raised a question of fact about the cause of the accident. Plaintiff slipped on wet plywood and fell as he was passing steel rebar to workers below. The court wrote, the deposition testimony raised issues of fact as to whether plaintiff's injuries were proximately caused by a slippery condition in violation of the Industrial Code, or whether the sole proximate cause was plaintiff's decision as a foreman to work on a plywood surface exposed to the elements while it was raining. The evidence is inconclusive as to whether plaintiff's decision to work in the rain, rather than simply following his general foreman's instructions about what work to perform, was the sole proximate cause of his slip and fall accident. This case is distinguishable from the line of cases relied upon by the dissent that conclude that a plaintiff is not the proximate cause of an accident when there is undisputed evidence that they were following the instructions of a foreman. Here, plaintiff was also a foreman with specific duties and potential control over the work that he and his crew were performing. Whether he could or should have ceased work based on his own authority as a foreman, his extensive work experience and conditions of the site, there are issues of fact that cannot be resolved on this record. So the takeaway here, the plaintiff was a foreman on the construction site. He was working in the rain when he slipped and fell on wet plywood. If plaintiff had the authority to stop work because of the rain, he may be deemed to be the sole proximate cause of his fall. If the plaintiff was ordered to work in the rain, then the slippery plywood may be deemed to be the sole proximate cause of his fall. Because there was conflicting and/or a lack of evidence on these issues, plaintiff's motion for summary judgment should not have been granted. Next is Reynoso, pages 15 and 16. It's another labor law action, this time involving 240 Subdivision 1, 241 Subdivision 6, and Labor Law 200. There were two issues in the case, one whether the homeowner's exemption applied, and two, whether the Labor Law 200 negligence cause of action should survive summary judgment. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the homeowner's exemption applied to preclude plaintiffs' labor law 241 and 241(6) causes of action in this latter fall case. The labor law 200 and negligence causes of action alleging that the defendant property owner's ladder was defective properly survived summary judgment. The fact that the property owner is a religious organization did not affect the applicability of the homeowner's exemption. The court wrote, "The deposition transcripts of the plaintiff and of the defendant's employee demonstrated that the defendant did not direct or control the plaintiff's work. The deposition transcript of the defendant's employee and the affidavit of the defendant's expert architect demonstrated that the defendant was the owner of a one-family dwelling to which the meditation room, which plaintiff was painting when he fell, was an accessory. Contrary to the plaintiff's contention, the defendant is entitled to the protections of this exemption, even though it is a religious organization. The defendant failed to demonstrate that it lacked notice of the allegedly dangerous or defective condition of the ladder," and that's why the Labor Law 200 and negligence causes of action survived summary judgment. So the takeaway here, the homeowner's exemption precludes Labor Law 241 and 241(6) causes of action against the homeowner who does not direct plaintiff's work, even if the homeowner is a religious organization. But the homeowner's exemption does not apply to Labor Law 200 or negligence causes of action here based on allegations the homeowner's ladder was defective. At this point, I'm going to insert the third verification code to be placed on your attorney affirmation for this April, May, June 2022 personal injury CLE, update CLE. The third verification code is Foreman. Again, the third verification code for this April, May, June 2022 personal injury update CLE is Foreman. Next is Carmona, pages 16 and 17. It's a landlord liability case. A shooting in the landlord's building. The second department held the defendants, the building owner and the building manager and the security company, were not entitled to summary judgment in this wrongful death case stemming from a shooting in the building. Although the specific crime, that being the shooting of plaintiff's decedent, may not have been foreseeable by the defendants, the relevant question was whether the building's door security was deficient and was therefore a concurrent factor in the shooting. The court wrote, "Under this department's jurisprudence, the test in determining summary judgment motions involving negligent door security should not focus on whether the crime committed within the building was targeted or random, but whether or not and to what extent an alleged negligently maintained building entrance was a concurrent contributory factor in the happening of the criminal occurrence. While the precise nature and manner of the shooter's crime could not necessarily have been anticipated, the alleged long-standing inoperability of the front door intercom system involving a front door that was unlocked remotely from an off-premises security booth, along with the alleged failure of the security officers to properly screen visitors, and the chronic problem of piggybacking made it foreseeable that some form of criminal conduct could occur to the detriment of one or more of the residents at some point in time. In examining whether there are tribal issues of fact as to issues of foreseeability and proximate cause requiring a trial, a jury could conceivably conclude that the alleged condition of the front door security equipment that included the inoperable intercom system, along with the failure of the security officers to engage in proper screening of visitors, would result in improper piggyback entry of intruders into the subject apartment building for the commission of criminal activities against known or unknown specific tenants." So the takeaway here, in the second department, a landlord can be liable for a crime committed in the landlord's building if the door security system was deficient and was therefore a concurrent factor in the happening of the crime. The plaintiff need not demonstrate the specific crime. Here the shooting of plaintiff's decedent could have been foreseen by the landlord. Next is Conra on pages 18 and 19. It's a medical malpractice case, and it involves emotional distress connected with a baby that may have been born alive or may have been stillborn. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the defendant's motion for summary judgment in this medical malpractice action should not have been granted because there is a question of fact whether the baby was born alive or was stillborn. The court wrote, "The plaintiffs commenced this action to recover damages for emotional distress allegedly sustained by the plaintiff, Christina Conra, as a result of the defendant's medical malpractice, which caused her to deliver a stillborn baby. The hospital records indicated that upon removal from the womb by cesarean section, it was observed that the infant was floppy and had no spontaneous respirations and had no heart rate. The defendants moved for summary judgment dismissing the first three causes of action, which were premised, among other things, upon Christina Conra's emotional distress, on the ground that the plaintiffs could not recover for any alleged emotional distress because the infant was born alive. The defendants established their prima facie entitlement to judgment as a matter of law by tendering evidence that the infant born to Christina Conra by emergency cesarean section was born alive, as a heartbeat was generated 20 minutes after the infant was removed from the womb as a result of continuous resuscitative efforts. However, in opposition, the plaintiffs raised a triable issue of fact as to whether the infant was in fact stillborn. As the infant had no respiratory response, the infant's Apgar score was 0 at 1 minute, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, and 15 minutes after the infant was removed from the womb. The infant otherwise had no indicia of life, and the infant was declared deceased approximately 2 hours after being removed from a ventilator. So the takeaway here, whether mother can recover for emotional distress in this medical malpractice action depended upon whether her baby was born alive or stillborn. There can be no recovery for mother's emotional distress if the baby was born alive. Because there were questions of fact about whether the baby was born alive, the defendant's motion for summary judgment should not have been granted. Next is Doe versus Langer, pages 19 and 20. Another medical malpractice case. Third Department held the Defendant Rehabilitation Support Services, that's RSS's, motion for summary judgment in this negligence, negligent supervision, medical malpractice, negligent infliction of emotional distress action was properly denied. Plaintiff was kidnapped and raped by Jose Marlett, who was under the care and supervision provided by RSS, a rehabilitation and recovery program for persons who have mental illness and substance abuse issues. The court wrote, Marlett had been an outpatient client at RSS for approximately 1 year and had been a resident in its apartment program for approximately 1 to 3 months prior to his receipt of personal recovery services. Marlett's application for RSS services included his diagnosis of bipolar disorder and schizoaffective disorder and a history of delusions, hallucinations, paranoia, suicidal and homicidal ideations, and incarceration. RSS identified Marlett's risks as suicide and violence and noted that he had a history of physical altercations, threatening and attempting to harm others, and was a danger to himself and others. In order to receive RSS services, Marlett was required to forego other psychiatric and mental health treatment, and RSS essentially became the exclusive provider of Marlett's medication management, clinical counseling, therapy, and psychiatric assessments. We find that defendants failed to prove a lack of duty to take reasonable steps to prevent Marlett from harming members of the general public. Defendants failed to submit a competent expert medical opinion, instead submitting a speculative and conclusory affidavit by its non-physician director that failed to provide any factual basis showing that they complied with professional standards. A cause of action for negligent infliction of emotional distress generally requires the plaintiff to show a breach of a duty owed to him or her which unreasonably endangered his or her physical safety or caused him or her to fear for his or her own safety. Unlike intentional infliction of emotional distress, the Court of Appeals has not stated that extreme and outrageous conduct is an essential element of a cause of action to recover damages for negligent infliction of emotional distress. So here, the defendant provided rehabilitative and recovery services for persons with mental illness and substance abuse problems. A person with a violent past was under defendant's care and supervision when he kidnapped and raped the plaintiff. The defendant did not demonstrate that it did not have a duty to protect members of the general public from a violent person under its care and supervision. So their summary judgment was denied. Next is ZL versus Mount Sinai Hospital on pages 21 and 22. It deals with preconception negligence and wrongful life. The First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that plaintiff's actions for preconception negligence and wrongful life should have been dismissed. Plaintiff mother had been treated for epilepsy for years with a drug, VPA, that's the name of the drug. She became pregnant while taking the drug and stopped taking it as soon as she learned she was pregnant. The baby was born with spina bifida. The court wrote, defendants treated the infant plaintiff's mother for epilepsy. To control her seizures, they prescribed valproic acid, that's VPA, which the mother had been taking for years while under the care of other physicians, unbeknownst to all. While she was on VPA, the mother conceived the infant plaintiff. Although the VPA was discontinued when the mother learned she was pregnant, the infant was born with spina bifida, for which she seeks to hold defendants responsible. It is well established that an infant has no cause of action for preconception negligence. The infant's claims that defendants failed to ensure that her mother was on birth control and monitored regularly for pregnancy while on VPA sound in wrongful life, for which there is no cause of action. So the takeaway here, New York does not recognize actions for preconception negligence or wrongful life. Here, mother alleged the epilepsy drug she was taking until she learned she was pregnant caused her baby to be born with spina bifida. Both causes of action should have been dismissed. Next is Lopez on page 22. The question here is whether the plaintiff could be compelled to undergo a psychiatric examination. The First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant's motions to compel plaintiff to appear for an independent medical examination and to vacate the note of issue should have been granted. The court wrote, we find that plaintiff's mental condition is in fact in controversy. Plaintiff requests compensatory damages only for her alleged emotional distress, and she has testified that she experienced depression, anxiety, and dizziness, as well as headaches brought on by severe mental anguish. As a result, a mental examination by a psychiatrist is warranted to enable defendants to rebut plaintiff's causes of action for emotional distress. We grant defendants' motion to vacate the note of issue. Contrary to the certificate of readiness, discovery had not yet been completed, as plaintiff had not yet complied with the court's directive to submit a Jackson affidavit detailing the process she had undertaken to search her social media post. So the takeaway here, plaintiff placed her mental condition in controversy by testifying about depression, anxiety, dizziness, and headaches caused by mental anguish. The defendant was entitled to compel a psychiatric exam. It's an independent medical exam. Here, defendant's motion to vacate the note of issue should have been granted because defendant's discovery was not complete. Next is Matter of Gabriel versus City of Long Beach on page 23. It's a late notice of claim case. Apparently the plaintiff passed out at a gas station, and the employees of the City of Long Beach Fire Department responded. The fire department employees treated the petitioner, and the petitioner alleged that that caused him to go into anaphylactic shock, which required that he be placed in a medically induced coma from June 30th until July 7th. The second department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the petition for leave to file a late notice of claim should have been granted. The notice of claim was served 5 days after the expiration of the 90-day time limit. The court deemed that to constitute timely knowledge of the claim. In other words, the late notice itself, which was 5 days late, 5 days after the 90-day time limit, was deemed by the court to have provided timely knowledge of the claim to the city. And the city didn't demonstrate prejudice, and therefore the absence of an excuse for the late filing was not a fatal defect. The court wrote, "The petitioner served the notice of claim upon the respondents 5 days after the 90-day period for service had expired and commenced the instant proceeding the next day. Under such circumstances, the respondents acquired actual knowledge of the essential facts constituting the claim within a reasonable time after the expiration of the 90-day statutory period. Since the respondents acquired timely knowledge of the essential facts constituting the petitioner's claim, the petitioner met his initial burden of showing a lack of prejudice. The respondents failed to come forward with particularized evidence showing that the late notice had substantially prejudiced their ability to defend the claim on the merits. Rather, the respondents' counsel made only conclusory assertions that the petitioner's 5-day delay in serving the notice of claim had hindered the respondents' ability to conduct a prompt and thorough investigation of the incident, which were insufficient to rebut petitioner's initial showing of a lack of prejudice. Although the petitioner failed to offer a reasonable excuse for his failure to timely serve the notice, the absence of a reasonable excuse is not fatal where there's actual notice and an absence of prejudice." So the takeaway here, the notice of claim was served 5 days late, and the court found that that gave the city timely notice of the nature of the claim. And the fact that the claim was only 5 days late also demonstrated the city was not prejudiced. Therefore, the fact that the petitioner didn't have an adequate excuse for not filing on time was not a fatal defect, and the petition to file a late notice of claim should have been granted. Next is English on pages 24 and 25. It's a long-arm jurisdiction case, products liability, toxic torts, involving exposure to asbestos in a talcum powder. The first department held New York had specific long-arm jurisdiction of defendant Schulten, the manufacturer and distributor of talcum powder alleged to have caused plaintiff's peritoneal mesothelioma. Plaintiff English was a flight attendant for 30 years who used the talcum powder when she stayed in New York. Schulten has its principal place of business in New Jersey, but has an office in New York and markets the product in New York. The court wrote, English, a Texas resident, was employed as a flight attendant for 33 years from 1966 to 1999. During a substantial part of that time, she used Desert Flower on a daily basis after showering. From 1966 to 1984, English was regularly assigned to flights into New York and flew into the state 2 to 4 times a month. She usually remained in New York on 2 or 3 day layovers. When English traveled, she packed Desert Flower in her luggage so she would have it available for use when she showered. There's no claim that the Desert Flower English used was used in New York was purchased in New York. Schulten is incorporated in New Jersey, where it had its principal place of business during the time that English claims to have used Desert Flower. Schulten never manufactured desert flour in New York, and in the mid-1970s, the manufacture of its talc products shifted from Tennessee to New Jersey. Desert flour was marketed nationally, including in New York. During the relevant periods of time, Schulten maintained a New York office from which it conducted its marketing activities for the cosmetics and toiletries division. The New York office was also headquarters for its international division. Schulten's maintenance of its own New York office satisfies the first prong of CPLR 302A1. Desert flour was marketed and sold nationally, and English used desert flour when she traveled to and while she stayed in New York. Schulten's activities and contacts with New York and the allegedly hazardous talcum powder used by English are sufficient to support an assertion of specific jurisdiction over Schulten. So the takeaway here, even though plaintiff was a Texas resident and the company she was suing was based in New Jersey, she was able to sue using New York courts. Plaintiff was a flight attendant for 30 years with monthly stayovers in New York. Defendant had an office in New York and marketed the talcum powder, which allegedly caused plaintiff's mesothelioma nationwide. Next is Barnett, pages 25 and 26. It's a slip and fall and an assault and battery case where the plaintiff didn't have recall of what actually happened. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiff's deposition testimony that he didn't recall how or where he slipped and fell, and with respect to his assault cause of action, did not recall the fight or being hit was fatal to the complaint. The court wrote, "In a slip and fall case, a plaintiff's inability to identify the cause of the fall is fatal to the cause of action because a finding that the defendant's negligence, if any, proximately caused plaintiff's injuries would be based on speculation." Here, with regard to that branch of their motion, which was for summary judgment, dismissing the cause of action alleging negligence, the defendants established, prima facie, that the plaintiff could not identify the cause of his alleged fall without engaging in speculation. To sustain a cause of action to recover damages for assault, there must be proof of physical conduct placing the plaintiff in imminent apprehension of harmful contact. Here the plaintiff testified at his deposition he could not recall a physical altercation at the premises on the date of the alleged incident and did not recall being hit. So the takeaway, in a slip and fall case, the failure to recall the cause of the fall requires dismissal. In an assault and battery case, the failure to recall the fight or being hit requires dismissal. Next is Bovee on page 29. It's another slip and fall case, and here, although the plaintiff couldn't identify which of two cracks caused his fall, the defendant was not entitled to summary judgment in this slip and fall case. The Third Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant's motion for summary judgment in the slip and fall case should not have been granted on the ground plaintiff could not identify the cause of his fall. Plaintiff alleged that one of two cracks in the pavement caused the fall. The court wrote, plaintiff testified that on the day of the incident, the weather was clear, there was no snow or debris on the surface of the parking lot. He parked his car in the parking lot and was approaching the front door of the store when his foot suddenly hit something along the pavement and stopped, causing him to fall to the ground. An individual who was walking behind plaintiff came to his aid, helping plaintiff up off the ground and assisting him back to his vehicle. At the time of his fall, plaintiff did not look at the ground to determine the cause. However, he recalled that after being helped back to his vehicle, he looked back and noticed a cracked area of the pavement where he had fallen. Plaintiff was shown photographs of the parking lot and identified the location of his fall by circling in one of the photographs an uneven area of pavement with two cracks in close proximity to one another. Upon further questioning, plaintiff was unable to identify which of the two cracks caused the fall, but repeatedly testified that he knew it was one of those two cracks based upon where he landed when he fell. Although plaintiff's statements were not without some inconsistencies, he was steadfast in his testimony that he tripped on one of the two identified cracks in the pavement of the parking lot. Despite Supreme Court's suggestion to the contrary, plaintiff was not required to state for certain which particular crack caused him to fall in order to withstand summary judgment. So the takeaway here, plaintiff was unable to testify that one of two cracks in the pavement was the cause of his fall, but the cause was sufficiently identified to withstand the defendant's summary judgment motion. At this point, I'm going to insert the fourth verification code to be placed on the attorney affirmation for this April, May, June 2022 personal injury update COE. The fourth verification code is cause. Again, the fourth verification code for this April, May, June 2022 personal injury update COE is cause. Next is Ivory versus City of New York. It's on page 30. It's another slip and fall, this time involving a tree well in New York City within a sidewalk. The Second Department reversing Supreme Court held the defendant property owner and manager could not be held liable for the condition of a tree well within a city sidewalk. Therefore, their motion for summary judgment in the slip and fall case should have been granted. The court wrote, Administrative Code of the City of New York, Section 7-210, which became effective September 14, 2003, shifted tort liability for injuries arising from a defective sidewalk from the city to the abutting property owner. However, Section 7-210 does not impose civil liability on property owners for injuries that occur in city-owned tree wells. Thus, liability may be imposed on the abutting landowner in such instances only where she or he has affirmatively created the dangerous condition, negligently made repairs to the area, or caused the dangerous condition to occur through a special use of that area. So the defendant's summary judgment motion, the abutting property owner and property manager, their motions for summary judgment should have been granted. The takeaway here, under the New York City Administrative Code, abutting property owners can be liable for a slip and fall due to the condition of the sidewalk, but not a city-owned tree well. Next is Descalo on page 31. It's a slip and fall case, and it deals with the open and obvious issues. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that a flattened cardboard box was not actionable in the slip and fall case. The court wrote, The plaintiff commenced this action to recover damages for personal injuries after she slipped and fell on a flattened cardboard box that was lying on the floor in an aisle of the defendant's grocery store. At her deposition, the plaintiff testified that she saw the cardboard box prior to the accident, as well as an employee of the defendant stocking shelves in the aisle close by. The plaintiff testified that prior to her fall, it was her intention to step onto the cardboard in order to reach a product on a shelf nearby. While a possessor of real property has a duty to maintain that property in a reasonably safe condition, there's no duty to protect or warn against an open and obvious condition that, as a matter of law, is not inherently dangerous. Here, defendant established its entitlement to judgment as a matter of law, dismissing the complaint by submitting evidence demonstrating that the flattened cardboard box, which was readily observable to the plaintiff prior to her fall, was open and obvious and not inherently dangerous. So the takeaway here, a flattened cardboard box on the floor was not actionable in this slip and fall case because the box was an open and obvious condition that was not dangerous. Next is Frank on page 33. Here there were two separate traffic accidents that were unrelated with different defendants, but the plaintiff claimed that the second accident exacerbated the injuries from the first accident. The court determined that it was necessary to have a joint trial. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiff's two separate traffic accidents should be tried jointly because plaintiff claimed The second accident exacerbated the injuries from the first accident. The court wrote, in view of the plaintiff's allegations that certain injuries which he sustained in the first automobile accident were exacerbated by the second automobile accident, in the interest of justice and judicial economy, and to avoid inconsistent verdicts, the two actions should be tried jointly. The respondents failed to demonstrate prejudice to a substantial right if the actions are tried jointly. Although the plaintiff moved to consolidate the two actions, the appropriate procedure is a joint trial, particularly since the actions involve different defendants. So the takeaway here, two separate traffic accidents should be tried together because plaintiff alleged the second accident exacerbated his injuries from the first accident. Next is Handelsman, pages 34 and 35. It's a traffic accident case involving a police chase. And one of the interesting aspects of the case is there was no contact between the police vehicle and the plaintiff's vehicle. And another interesting issue is whether the police were negligent in failing to notify the dispatcher of the chase. First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiffs raised questions of fact about whether the police acted in reckless disregard of the safety of others during a high-speed chase, and whether the chase of the BMW driven by Llewellyn was a proximate or concurrent cause of the accident. Neither vehicle involved in the chase struck plaintiff's vehicle. The court wrote, the motion court properly held that the reckless disregard standard applied in evaluating the city defendant's conduct in pursuing Llewellyn. However, the motion court erred in determining that there is no evidence that the NYPD officers acted recklessly as a matter of law and that the pursuit was not the proximate cause or concurrent cause of this incident. Plaintiffs submitted evidence that the city defendants initiated a high-speed chase of Llewellyn's BMW at close proximity after observing it run a single red light and continued the high-speed chase, which included crossing over a double yellow line and running two red lights in a known congested and heavily populated residential area, which at the time of the pursuit had moderate to heavy traffic and numerous pedestrians. Plaintiffs also raised an issue of fact concerning whether the NYPD officers acted recklessly in failing to notify the radio dispatcher at the start of the pursuit and inform headquarters with relevant information, including the nature of the offense. So here there were questions of fact, whether the police acted in reckless disregard of the safety of others during a high-speed chase, such that the city would be liable for plaintiff's accident, and whether the high-speed chase was a proximate or concurrent cause of plaintiff's accident, where there was no contact with either vehicle involved in the chase. There were questions of fact whether the police drove in reckless disregard of the safety of others, and whether their failure to notify the dispatcher of the chase was also reckless. Next is Reed on pages 35 and 36. It's a traffic accident case, an intersection traffic accident case, and it raised the issue of whether the town was liable for overgrown foliage that blocked drivers' lines of sight, whether there was a negligent design of the intersection, and whether there was inadequate signage. Third Department, reversing Supreme Court in this Y intersection traffic accident case, held 1. The cause of action against the town alleging overgrown foliage blocked driver's line of sight should have been dismissed because the town demonstrated it did not have written notice of the condition. And 2. The written notice requirement does not apply to the causes of action alleging inadequate signage and negligent design, which properly survived summary judgment. The court wrote, by its submission of the affidavits of its town clerk and superintendent of highways, who both averred that after review of the pertinent records, no written notice was received pertaining to any alleged defective or dangerous condition caused by or from overgrown trees. The town successfully shifted the burden to plaintiffs to establish an issue of fact as to the prior written notice, which plaintiffs failed to do. As to plaintiffs' claims pertaining to inadequate signage and negligent design of the intersection, we agree that prior written notice requirements do not apply to those defects. The record demonstrates that at the very least, at some point in the modern era, the roads were paved and signage was installed. The town has provided no proof as to when or how often these activities have been undertaken, or that they were completed in compliance with the standards in place at the time. We agree that Supreme Court properly rejected the town's contention that plaintiffs' allegations of negligence by the town were negated by the driver's familiarity with the intersection. It cannot be said that this Y intersection was reasonably safe as a matter of law, nor did the town conclusively demonstrate that placing the stop sign in a different location would have resulted in the same conduct by the drivers. Tribal issues of fact exist as to whether the signage at the intersection was a proximate cause of the accident. So the takeaway here, in a traffic accident case, a municipality will not be liable for overgrown foliage which blocks lines of sight if the town has not been provided with written notice of the condition. But the written notice requirement does not apply to causes of action alleging the accident was caused by inadequate signage or negligent roadway design. Next is Matter of Sequino, pages 36 and 37. This is a workers' compensation case. It deals with an appellate issue and the obligations of the workers' compensation board with respect to creating a record for the appeals court. The third department reversing the Workers' Compensation Board held the board did not explain its decision to deny coverage of 25 medical bills based on the conclusion the bills did not relate to claimant's medical condition. The court wrote, although the board has the exclusive province to resolve conflicting medical opinions and to evaluate medical evidence before it, and its factual determinations on causal relationship will not be disturbed if supported by substantial evidence in the record, its decision here fails to indicate what medical opinions or reports form the basis for the conclusions reached regarding causal relationship. It is noted that many of the bills or supporting records include multiple diagnoses and charges, with some of the diagnoses appearing to match the established conditions, such as treatment for a urinary tract infection. No basis is provided for denying compensability for portions of the bills related to established conditions, that is, for denying payment for the entire medical bill based upon the inclusion of non-compensable treatment in the bill or records. By failing to provide the reasons for its rulings or the basis upon which the determination was made, the workers' compensation law judge and the board failed to satisfy their obligation to provide some basis for appellate review. So the takeaway here, when the Workers' Compensation Board or the Workers' Compensation Law judge fails to adequately explain its denial of coverage for medical bills, which it concluded were not related to claimant's medical condition, appellate review by the court is not possible and the matter will be remitted. Next is Matter of Cromer on pages 37 and 38, another workers' compensation case which raises a couple of issues. The third department, reversing the Workers' Compensation Board, held that the schedule loss of use, that's the SLU award for a shoulder injury, should not have been offset by a prior award for an elbow injury. Rather, whether the second injury resulted in an increased loss of use should have been considered. The court wrote, the board credited Coniglio's, that's the employer's expert's, opinion of a 20% schedule loss of use as being consistent with the guidelines and expressly declined to add any additional loss of use. We note that the board has previously determined that adding value for posterior extension to an overall SLU award that also includes a documentation of deficits of flexion and abduction is consistent with the guidelines. The board did not address Coniglio's failure to add any value for his finding of a posterior extension defect to his overall SLU calculation and, as such, has not provided a rational basis for departing from its precedent. Accordingly, its finding of a 20% schedule loss of use of the left arm must be reversed and the matter remitted for further consideration by the board. So the takeaway here, claimant's prior schedule loss of use award for an elbow injury was not considered in connection with the schedule loss of use for the subsequent shoulder injury, which is a departure from the board's precedent. Because the departure from precedent was not explained, the decision was reversed and remitted. And the final case in the June personal injury reversal report, pages 38 and 39, it's another workers' compensation case dealing with the misinterpretation by the board of special consideration number 4 in the workers' compensation guidelines. The third department, reversing the workers' compensation board, held special consideration 4 of the workers' compensation guidelines for determining impairment was not properly interpreted, resulting in a schedule loss of use for claimant's leg that is inappropriately low. That was 10%. The court wrote, claimant argues that the board's interpretation of special consideration 4 and the instructions regarding its application is irrational and runs afoul of the purpose of workers' compensation law section 15 subdivision 3. We agree. Schedule loss of use awards are not given for particular injuries, but they are made to compensate an injured worker for his or her loss of earning power or capacity that is presumed to result as a matter of law from the residual permanent physical and functional impairments to statutorily enumerated body members. Relying on the plain language of the 2018 guidelines, the board reads special consideration 4 as making no provision for additional values due to flexion or extension deficits, reasoning that the enumerated schedule loss of use range already takes into account range of motion deficits. The board's interpretation of the instructions results in the obvious inequity identified by claimant and cannot be upheld. To accept the board's interpretation would be to sanction an application of the 2018 guidelines that results in claimants with only meniscus tears routinely receiving schedule loss of use awards far greater than 7.5% to 10% based upon their range of motion deficits. So to put it in plain language, in determining the schedule loss of use for claimant's leg, the Workers' Compensation Board misinterpreted Special Consideration 4, resulting in an inappropriately low schedule loss of use percentage. That concludes this April, May, June 2022 personal injury CLE update.